Welcome back to the program. Certainly over the years, much has been written and said about the state of the tobacco industry. We know that cigarettes are the only legal product that, if used as directed, can kill us. But little do we fully understand the degree to which that product has been manipulated by the tobacco industry to be even far more deadly than we thought. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Robert Proctor. He's a professor of history of science at Stanford University. He's the author of the previous book, Cancer Wars, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his newest work, Golden Holocaust. Robert Proctor, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. We know that cigarettes are bad. We know over the years the tobacco companies have lied to us repeatedly, that they have marketed this product to it that has these deadly effects. But in fact, one of the things that you detail extensively in Golden Holocaust is the degree to which so many other chemicals are part of the way cigarettes have been manipulated. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, there's basically about 630 different chemicals that have been added to cigarettes over time, and basically the world's herbal and aromatic chests have been raided for this purpose, and some of them are really bizarre, like castoreum, which is a secretion from the anal gland of the Siberian beaver. But you've got that. You've also got ammonia being added to cigarettes in order to freebase the nicotine. You've got levulinic acid added in order to facilitate binding of the nicotine molecule in the brain. So it's really a kind of witch's brew of compounds that they've added all to create and sustain addiction.
And talk about why all of these chemicals have been added, because certainly all of them are not precursors to addiction. Some of them seem to have other reasons why they've been added to the cigarette mix.
Yeah, that's right, and the reasons can even change over time. For example, chocolate used to be added to various kinds of tobacco as early as the 19th century. But now it seems to be added because it contains theobromine, which is actually a bronchodilator. And so and it facilitates inhalation, basically making the cigarette much more like an inhaler. So there are a lot of different reasons that compounds are added. Menthol is added because it gives a medicinal aspect. And actually, menthol cigarettes used to be only smoked when people had a cold, and they became essentially a normal part of cigarettes in the 1950s with the so-called health scare, and so a lot of people actually smoked menthol cigarettes thinking they were safer. So there's a lot of reasons they put that stuff in.
If we look at cigarettes in the early days, pre-1950s even, in terms of tobacco, is that tobacco, quote-unquote, healthier?
I don't think it's healthier. You'd have to go back to before the 19th century, and that tobacco use is definitely healthier. In other words, cigarette smoke used to be quite harsh. It had a pH of about 8. It was quite alkaline, quite basic, and that meant that you couldn't inhale it. So cigarette smoke is really not inhaled prior to the 19th century. In the 19th century, the tobacco makers invent a process called flue curing, and flue curing basically traps the sugars in the tobacco leaf instead of having them degrade when you air cure them. And what those extra sugars do is they make a much more neutral smoke. The sugars burn and they produce acids, and that counteracts the nicotine alkaloid. And as a result, the cigarette is much more neutral in terms of its basic chemistry, and as a result becomes inhalable, and for the first time cigarettes are inhaled, and that's what leads to the entire lung cancer, chronic obstructive disease epidemic. So tobacco is definitely safer prior to the 20th century.
How much of the chemical addition that we're talking about is as a result of manipulating the tobacco itself as it's grown, and how much is the addition of chemicals after the fact?
Well, it's both of those. In other words, the tobacco industry adjusts the nicotine content, and I mean the actual mass of the nicotine in the cigarette, to within 2 decimal points. So it'll be 1.86% nicotine or 1.72% nicotine. And so there's extreme precision used in the manipulation, and that's done through many different procedures, agriculturally, according to where you pick the leaf on the plant. The top leaves have more nicotine than the bottom leaves. according to how much fertilizer you put on the plant, according to how much sun it gets, how much water it gets, how close they're planted. So there are lots of different ways it's manipulated already in the ground. And then once it's delivered to the warehouses and the bulkers, it'll be manipulated according to pesticides being sprayed on it. And look, you've got to remember there are 20 different pesticides that are applied onto the product at various stages, even in the factory. And so those residues get on there as well. So it's a highly manipulated product. Literally tens of billions of dollars have been spent by tobacco industry chemists manipulating this product over the decades.
You don't see anybody out there selling organic cigarettes.
Well, actually, you do. That, of course, is the fashion as well. So you have the Santa Fe Tobacco Company producing American Spirit, which are supposedly organic. You know, that's a kind of a greenwashing trick, I would say.
So
not so much that all these manipulations make it more hazardous. In a way, they make it just more seductive.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how long this has been going on.
Well, of course, the tobacco plant itself is a Native American product. It goes back thousands of years. I think you've got Olmec use of the tobacco plant. But the cigarette itself, depending on how you define it, is a fairly recent invention. It, depending on whether you count it as being the paper or the pH or the size. In other words, a cigarette is just a small cigar, literally. And you do get small cigars already in the Mesoamerican era. They're Native American small cigars, which makes sense. But the use of paper seems to be a product of the 16th and 17th century in Spain, where the poor people would gather up scraps of tobacco, discarded tobacco waste, and they'd roll it in newspapers and smoke that. But it's not really till the 19th century that you get a factory-scale production of cigarettes, where you're rolling this thing and actually producing it as essentially an infinite tube, and then it's cut by whirling shears. And that really changes the nature of the process. It becomes much more chemicalized, much more manipulated at that point.
When were filters added, and what impact did those filters have?
Well, filters go back to the 19th century in a sense, because filters are really not filters. They're just mouthpieces. This is probably the single biggest myth. I know on your show you like to puncture myths, and I was thinking this is probably one of the biggest ones. Filters are really not filters at all. They're just like mouthpieces, and they're put on there to keep the little tobacco bits out of your mouth, and they're put on there to save on costs, because that cellulose acetate is actually cheaper than the actual tobacco. But they're mainly put on there to fool people into thinking that something's being filtered out, and it's really not. Filters are no less deadly than non-filtered cigarettes. They really are not filters at all. They're more like faucets that the smoker themselves controls just by inhaling harder. So if they're tight, you can just pull on the cigarette a little harder and get as much tar and nicotine. And if they're loose, you know, it's as if they weren't there either. So, in other words, you can compress tobacco and make it hard to pull through, and that works essentially like a so-called filter. But there's really no difference. Mm-hmm. Filters are completely fraudulent.
What are we seeing now in terms of the difference in the final product of the cigarette between those that are being manufactured, for example, here in the States versus those that are being manufactured and sold in China and the rest of Asia?
Yeah, there's no difference. The same machines are being used. There are only three or four companies in the world that make cigarette-making machines, and these are the world's deadliest machines, and they're centered in Hamburg and Bologna. The same machines are used, the same ingredients are used. Now, the Chinese are trying to do what they call a Chinese-specific cigarette, and it has various special herbs and things, but that's just a gimmick. The cigarette is one of the most uniform products. It is partly because it's made by these same machines and has such similar ingredients. And so there's really no difference throughout the world.
To what extent has there been any transparency at any point on the part of the tobacco industry with respect to some of these additional chemicals that are part of the process?
Well, they still don't give the formulas. They regard those as trade secrets. They don't list the ingredients. Some of the ingredients are sometimes listed on the websites, and they have been disclosed to the FDA. But the composition, the fractions are not released, and they don't talk about what's in the paper. I mean, remember, you know, for every cigarette you smoke, you're smoking paper as well, and that's got ink on it, it's got bleaching agents, whitening agents, burn accelerants, burn retardants, lots of chemicals just in the paper, and actually for a time, people thought that was actually the dangerous part. So there's very little transparency. On the other hand, the tobacco industry is so powerful, they've managed to push through Congress data transparency laws, making sure that any of the critics of the industry, that there's a lot of transparency in their critics. So transparency is kind of a double-edged sword, but they certainly have not been forthcoming about what they're actually doing.
Talk a little bit about the process by which you put all of this information together, particularly with respect to all the many chemicals that are part of the cigarette.
Well, we now have 70 or 80 million pages of formerly secret documents from the industry, and these are online, and if you go to the Legacy Tobacco Documents Library, you can actually search for these various ingredients. You can search ginger, or you can search diethylene glycol, or you can search polonium. There's polonium in cigarettes, the radioactive isotope, which comes in through the fertilizers used, and the industry has been very worried about having that made public. And there's a 1978 document where they say that if the public finds out about this, it'll be like waking a sleeping giant. So they really don't want that to be known about. They don't want people to know about the gas and cigarettes. So what you can do is you just plug into these archives specific chemical compounds, and you can get how they're added, when they're added, where they're added. You can put in the pesticides. This is a very, very revealing source into the bowels of the industry.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you argue is that cigarettes should not just be discouraged or prohibited, but in fact they should be abolished.
Right, yes.
Talk about that.
Well, I learned this basically from talking to smokers. It's as if we have two separate worlds now in the United States, the world of the non-smoker and the world of the smoker. And the non-smokers really don't know, I don't think, much about what it's like to smoke. And when you talk to smokers, what they'll say is that, you know, please don't tax it. You know, I'm addicted, I'll just end up paying more. And most smokers are addicted, profoundly addicted. It's very different from, say, wine or alcohol, where only about 3% of people who drink alcohol are addicted, whereas with tobacco, it's about 90% of people who use cigarettes are addicted. So it's very profoundly different. And the smokers are not happy about the fact they smoke. They dislike the fact they smoke overwhelmingly. In fact, there's something called regret studies that show that 80 or 90% of smokers eventually come to regret the fact they ever started, and of course that number goes even higher once they get diagnosed with the disease. So it has a different political calculus from, say, alcohol, and that's why the comparison to prohibition, you know, 1920 style prohibition, is really unfair. Alcohol is a recreational drug. You know, people don't go to a party and say, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to drink some wine. I apologize for that. I wish I wasn't drinking this wine. You know, people enjoy alcohol, but that's not true with cigarettes. People don't like the fact they enjoy it. And that's what led me to the idea that really, in the service of freedom, it would be better to not have this product sold, and that this is very different from say, alcohol.
How does this relate to other forms of tobacco, chewing tobacco, cigars, etc.?
Well, that's a great question because, in fact, some of these other forms of tobacco use can be used recreationally. For example, premium cigars, I think, are actually recreational drugs. There are only 250 million sold every year in the United States as opposed to the 350 billion cigarettes smoked. They tend to be used recreationally, episodically, not on a daily basis. So there are types of tobacco products, or nicotine, you might say, uh-huh. that are used more or less recreationally. And that is an interesting difference, and I think it should probably be taken into account in terms of policy. Chewing tobacco is a bit of a mixed story because it's not as deadly as cigarettes, but on the other hand, it's used by kids a lot, especially in sports. And there's a lot of deception, I think, going on there, and I think that's a big problem.
Would you argue that the abolition of cigarettes should fall under the guise of a significant public health issue, or is it a criminal issue?
Well, it's certainly a public health issue. Criminal, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm sure there have probably been some criminal activities going on there. But certainly as a public health issue, it's the biggest in the world. We've still got over 400,000 people dying every year from cigarettes, and that's just in the U.S. It's about 6 million people die every year worldwide from cigarettes. And there's no bigger public health problem. It also is a financial cost, and it's even a cause of global warming. In my book, I show that actually the manufacturing of cigarettes is a huge resource waste in terms of petrochemicals. It's a huge waste in terms of paper, you know, products, all types of things, and it's actually a contributor to global warming because of all the old-growth forest that ends up being cut down for the flu curing process. So it's a kind of an overdetermined thing. I think actually it's going to be the environmental consequences that result in the banning of cigarettes.
Why do you think that the banning of cigarettes is possible even in the current environment?
Well, this is another one of the great things, again, if you want to puncture myths. People seem to think, we've been sort of brainwashed by the tobacco industry in thinking that smoking is a form of free speech. In fact, that was in the 1980s and 90s, the tobacco industry becomes the leading distributor of Bill of Rights in the country and flags in the country. And they really tried to say that smoking is this ultimate rock-bottom freedom, but that's really not true, and it's not true historically. In the 1890s up until the 1920s, 15 different U.S. states actually banned the sale of cigarettes, and quite successfully. And when this was challenged, it was actually upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, the right of every local community and every state to ban the sale of cigarettes is fully guaranteed. And this is in the U.S. Supreme Court in Austin versus Tennessee in 1900. This decision, this ruling was made and has never been challenged. So if the city of Napa or Belmont wanted to pass a law barring the sale of cigarettes in that local community, that would be fully constitutional. It's a great example where the citizenry has much more power than it realizes, and since it doesn't know this is possible, doesn't even exercise that power.
What about the slippery slope argument that to the extent that we abolish and or ban cigarettes today, that tomorrow it's sugary soft drinks because of the public health consequences, and the day after something else?
That's right, yeah. Well, that's like saying, you know, if I walk to the beach, then I'll walk in the ocean and drown, you know, or if I ban lead paint, then I'll ban acrylic paint, or if I, in other words, slopes are only as slippery as you make them. I mean, we're adults, and we make laws, and we say it's legal or illegal to do something, and it doesn't imply that it's legal or illegal to do something else. So, you know, we're grown-ups, and we make laws, and slippery slope is really sort of the refuge of scoundrels. It's not a valid philosophical argument.
Right, but it certainly is one we hear from those that are against the abolition and against and pro-cigarette industry.
Yeah, that's right, and it's an invalid argument. If we can certainly ban cigarettes without banning wine. I mean, why would we slip down that slope? That would just be a silly slope to slip down. We let ourselves slide or we don't. It's in our hands.
I want to come back to a point that you made before in terms of the unique attitude of those that are smokers and how many people that are addicted to smoking wish they were not and would like to find a way out.
Right. Yeah, that's a really key point, and it really it changes the political nature of the argument. In other words, from a libertarian or civil libertarian point of view, you can say cigarettes should be banned. They're just too dangerous to be consumed. It enlarges freedom rather than confines it. In other words, you know, my grandmother died of emphysema from smoking, and how free was she made by that product? You know, health deprived, does not liberate you. That's one of the reasons I talk about abolition and not prohibition, going back to your early question, because the opposite of prohibition is freedom, but the opposite of abolition is slavery. And it's really, I think, this smoking slavery that we want to worry about. And that's why I think it will actually enlarge human freedoms to get rid of cigarettes.
Talk a little bit about how you think the tobacco companies will respond to this. I don't mean respond in terms of obviously opposed to it, but how will they counter the arguments?
Well, basically by cutting off business in the U.S. They've already started down that path. They basically think 10 or 20 years ahead of everyone else, and so they're already basically pinching off the cigarette business in the United States, even though there's 350 billion cigarettes sold here. That's down by about half from what it was a couple decades ago. So they'll go after the Chinese markets, and they'll go after Africa and Eastern Europe, as they're already doing. You know, they won't like it. They'll fight it, but they'll eventually give it up. There was a while back they were actually diversifying into other products, and so Philip Morris became the largest food producer in the United States, for example, food distributor. And that was in the 1980s and 90s, but they've moved back more into a pure tobacco play. So they'll, of course, fight it. But Lorillard has bought a electronic cigarette company, so they'll push that direction more, kind of what's called a clean nicotine approach. So they'll be trying a number of different approaches.
Talk about that clean nicotine approach, as well as this interest that sort of surged for a while and then regressed in smokeless tobacco.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the smokeless, they're still pushing that, too. They see the frontiers into some kind of tarless tobacco. And so they'll be pushing that. The electronic cigarettes, you're seeing that more and more advertised. I don't think those will be terribly successful because it's not a very fun experience, I think most people say. I mean, most people don't really like basically injecting nicotine through an electronic apparatus. But they'll try that. They'll try a number of other things.
Mm-hmm. Will we start to see, as cigarette smoking maybe gets cut back, will we start to see alternative nicotine delivery systems develop?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're already seeing lots of different forms of nicotine inhalers, and venture capitalists are going into this area. I've had them contacting me about various products. So there's a whole range of basically nicotine delivery things that are being developed, and that's going to happen too. But I think the big thing that's going to happen is the cigarette itself will get pinched off.
Robert Proctor, his book is Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition, just out from University of California Press. Robert, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Jeff, and again, I've really enjoyed your blog over the years.
Thank you very much.